This is a show where people tell true stories on a theme, in case you didn't know what the show was about. Tonight's theme was given to me by one of the storytellers on the show, and the theme is trespass. And I was trying to think of a good trespass story, and I thought of one that I thought really applied, but I think I may have told it at one of the open theme narrators. So if you've heard this before, I apologize. Since only about four people come to that show, I don't think anybody here has heard it. But if you're one of those four people, I apologize that you've heard this story before. When I was 17 years old, I was a really bad kid. So bad that my mom kicked me out of the house during the day. I wasn't allowed to be home. I could only be home when she was home at night. And then during the day, I had to just roam around my like suburban Littleton area where I lived. So I just spent all my days, you know, just hanging outside Safeway, smoking cigarettes, just being a total loser all the time. So I had a friend named Brent who was going out of town to Chicago on vacation. So my friend Brent said, "We're leaving town on vacation. I'll leave you a key outside my house, and you can just come into my house and hang out whenever you want." This was not sanctioned by his parents, I should mention. He was also like 16 or 17. He's like, "So, you know, when you have to leave your house, you can just hang out at my house. We'll be gone for 2 weeks." And I was like, "Awesome." So I did that. I would just go over to Brent's house, sit in his kitchen, like eat snacks, you know, just be bored over there. But I decided to have a party. That wasn't enough of an irresponsible choice. So I was like, "I'm going to have a party, and I'm going to have two of my friends come over." And by party, I mean we're going to smoke pot out back, drink wine coolers, and watch RoboCop on cable. That was the extent of the party that happened. But when you're 17, that's pretty good. That's not bad. That's not horrible. Living in Littleton, that's about as good as it gets. So my friends, their names are Jeremy and Brian. They were going to come over to Brent's house. I told him where the key was. I had to go to a concert, Stone Temple Pilots at Red Rocks. Killer show. Really good, you guys. Really good. it was one of the worst concerts I've ever been to in any venue, let alone one of the coolest venues. So I was at Stone Temple Pilots for the early part of the evening while Jeremy and Brent made themselves a home in my friend's house that we were not supposed to be in and had no actual permission to be in. So I show up maybe around 10 at night. I finally come back to Brent's. They're hanging out, you know, they've been smoking pot. They're like, "Hey, your dad came by earlier looking for you, and we told him you'd be back later." And I was like, "Okay, whatever. Fuck him. Like, I don't call my dad. I don't do anything." We hang out. We watch RoboCop. We're drinking wine coolers, you know, having all this fun. So we're down there in the basement, and I don't know what time it is. Maybe it's like 11 at night, 11:30 at night, and we keep hearing this loud noise from upstairs, like this loud thumping noise. So finally I go upstairs, I'm like, I don't know what it is. It's like a dishwasher or something. So I go upstairs, I'm standing at the top of the stairs, and I'm listening for it. I don't hear anything. I'm like, I don't know what this noise could be. And all of a sudden there's a flashlight beam in the side window, and I hear somebody yell, "Police, go to the front door!" And I'm like, holy shit. Like, so I'm like, "It's the police!" I like whisper downstairs. So I run into the front room, and at this point I realize, again, I'm 17, and I'm an idiot. I'm wearing a shirt that has a like a killer clown. This is before Insane Clown Posse existed, as if this justifies a shirt this stupid. But I don't want you to possibly think that this is an Insane Clown Posse shirt. This predates that. This is a different type of insane clown. This is different memorabilia. So there's this clown, this like mean-looking clown dude, or like a dude in clown makeup, and he's holding a pig dressed up as a cop, and he's holding an Uzi to the pig cop's head. And the 17-year-old me saw that shirt, had to buy it, wore it proudly all the time, and now I'm like going to answer the door to the police wearing the shirt. So I'm like, oh, fucking shit. So I like take the shirt off and stuff it behind the couch and then answer the door as smoothly as a person can answer the door, like out of breath and shirtless. Like, "Oh, hey, what's up?" Like, just hanging out, you know, just hanging out. And there's two police officers there and my dad standing behind the two police officers. And they're like, "Yeah, well, we got a call from your dad to come check out the scenario. What's going on?" I was like, "Oh, I'm just house sitting for my friend, just, you know, hanging out." They're like, "Is there anybody else in the house?" And I think, quick thinking, I'm like, "No, there's nobody else here," instead of just being honest and not getting in that much trouble. I'm like, "No, there's nobody else here, just me." I'm like, mind if we come in and have a quick look around? And I think that that's what it means, like, come in and take a quick look around. I'm like, yeah, my friends will be hiding. Not a big deal. I'm like, yeah, come on in, have a quick look around. So they come in, and they're instantly, like, flashlight over guns shit, like, going, like, room to room, like, checking everything. And I have to go before them and open up all these doors. So there's, like, there's a female cop and a male cop. The male cop goes downstairs. He's like, I'm gonna go check downstairs. And so the female cop makes me walk in front of her and open every door, like a jack-in-the-box surprise. Like, I'm gonna get shot in the back if, like, a balloon pops or something. So I'm walking along, and I'm thinking of my friends downstairs hiding and just waiting to hear them get shot at some point. Like, because that's what will happen. If the cop downstairs is acting like this woman is, he's going to open a closet door and just shoot my friends. So I'm like, oh, my God. Like, this is, what a terrible idea. Like, and again, I'm never like, oh, I have two friends downstairs. I forgot about that. I'm just, like, riding at it, like, okay, we're going to get into trouble. And then I hear from downstairs, like, three little yelps. Three, not two. Three yelps. Because there's three people down there, and the cop's like, go to the kitchen. So she, like, leads me into the kitchen. And the male cop comes up with my two friends, like, shame-faced. I found out later they were both just in closets, like, just standing there in a closet. So when he opened it. And then this cop, he comes upstairs. I'll never forget this for as long as I live. He looks at me genuinely hurt and says, you lied to me. And he, even then, it's like, dude, you're a cop. Like, this doesn't happen, like, eight times a day? It was just bizarre. Like, he was, like, legitimately hurt that I told him a tall tale about having friends in the basement. So they let us go. They believed the house-sitting story, but they're like, you have to go, and we're going to leave our card here, the police business card, and we're going to check up and talk to the homeowner. So I had to leave, and then, of course, my friend came home, and they came in from their vacation, and there was a police officer's card on the counter. Like, what do you think? You think he probably got burglarized? So I had to go, and I had to call, and I had to go in and, like, apologize to my friend's parents and everything. And then, at the very end, they're like, if you wanted to house it, you just should have asked. We would totally let you house it. There wasn't even a lesson learned. They just offered to let me house it if in the future I wanted to trespass in their home again. All I had to do was ask first, and then it would be okay. So, that's my story. We have a great show for you tonight. Thank you very much. We have a super show for you tonight. A lot of great guests from out of town. Your first guest is, he's actually the storyteller who gave me tonight's theme. He's a fixture on the storytelling scene and runs his own show called Stories, Stories, Bring Your Stories, the fourth Tuesday of every month at the Mercury Cafe. So if you love story shows, definitely check out his show because it's a lot of fun and very cool. Please welcome Ed Ward.
This is a story that explains how a bear from 1974 could trespass on the imagination of someone in 2010. Okay, it's called In Keeping with the Notion, We Are Not Ghosts, A Tale to Tell, entitled What I Always Knew. 37 years ago, I went on a wild and come-what-may adventure. My former lifestyle of being married to my childhood sweetheart and teaching high school English in the quintessential small-town Jersey suburb of Philadelphia, well, that life was over. Although I would teach for another year after my sojourn west, I knew at its start that I needed to and soon would be reinventing myself, as up until then my life had seemed swayed more by chance than choice. I had married young in pursuit of love and sexual fulfillment, as my Catholic upbringing required me to do so if I wanted to remain in God's good graces. And then I went and destroyed a damn good marriage by having an affair. I felt such guilt I gave my ex everything. The house, the car, the dog, the bank account. I might have orchestrated a reconciliation, most likely could have pulled it off, but I put the nail in the coffin of my first love from my wife with my going, going, gone on my ramblings, south, then west, and then south, and then back east again. The hand in life I'd been dealt was a mixed one. There was poverty. I mean, there were times growing up that my mother wouldn't give me a dime. And I'm speaking literally, not 10 cents. And the answer to why not is because she did not have 10 cents. There were my looks, a mixed signal as ever, my face to the world, color-changing eyes, some days blue, some days green, some days hazel or some other color in between, curly-haired and fit, but with teeth considered odd, and so the somber smile. My mind was keen, but I disliked study. I figured Einstein just always knew that E equals MC squared, that Bob Dylan just always knew how to write songs. With naivety, yet how right I was, I supposed I would eventually just figure out what I always knew and go from there. I hoped it's something noble, that I would someday, you know God or be touched by his mother, you know, witness a miracle or have eureka moments of insight into the nature of what this world is all about. There was my education, top-notch Jesuit prep school and private university in Philadelphia, but I must say that my 4 years at St. Joe's Prep and my 4 years at Drexel University were years wherein every day my time at school was a dream I awoke from in the afternoon on the bus, subway, and trolley ride home to my neighborhood life of family and friends. At least my education and subsequent stint as a teacher kept me out of the Vietnam War, even if those times shed not enough light on how to learn what I always knew. Every man is wired to know something, it's just that every man is not conscious of his knowledge. So off I go on my great adventure, a summer of hitchhiking with no destination going, no destination home. Wherever my thumb took me, I would go, and I indeed had a grand time. A week into my soloing, I hooked up with one Lucia Cilento. She was hitchhiking back to New York from Georgia with 3 other women to save bus fare, and we crossed paths at a campground on Cape Hatteras. We flirted, we got high, Lucia and her friends slept in my tent. In the morning, Lucy and I swam naked in the rough surf of the Atlantic. We kissed and we fucked all within 24 hours of meeting. I asked Lucia to join me on my great adventure, and a week later, after she hitchhiked home to wrap up some affairs, we rendezvoused in Jersey and spent a William Blake and Jack Kerouac-esque summer on the road. Our time together and the particulars of our adventure is the stuff of novels, complete with mystical discovery of what it is one knows. Lucy and I were both very interested in understanding what the other knew. I discovered what I always knew via my involvement with her, namely, that life is how you write it, that life is of one's own making, one's own invention. Nonetheless, our summer romance turned out to be just that, a summer romance, after which she went her way and I went mine, and we lost contact with each other. From what she told me of her dreams and hopes during our time together, I figured she was probably living somewhere in Europe or Africa, for Lucia was always interested in what was in beyond the horizon. And so, a quarter of a century after our summer fling and great adventure, I write and publish my novel, Lucy and Eddie, wherein I use my time with Lucia from beginning to end as the framework for a sometimes true, sometimes fictional retelling of our adventures. The narrative's a hoot, if I do say so myself, and many readers tell me they can't put it down. Oddly, more than one former student of mine from my years of teaching long ago has Facebooked me that he or she, to quote, always knew what my novel reveals. A year or so after publication of my novel, I gain access to the internet with the purchase of a Millennium computer. One day, early in my exploration of the uses of the internet, I type the name Lucia Cilento into the search engine of my browser, and up pops the question, do you mean Lucy Cilento? I clicked on yes, and soon an image of a Lucia I had shared a summer with filled the screen of my monitor. She was 25 years older, but instantly recognizable. The thick black hair, the sparkling eyes, the tilt of her head and confident stance. She appeared as an advocate for nursing, testifying about how and why she came to be and loved being a nurse. Midwives had attended the birth of her first child when she lived in Norway, and they so impressed her with their skills and womanly powers that upon her return to America some years later, she had attended nursing school. About her chosen career, she was ecstatic. There was no personal contact information given for Lucia on the nurse advocacy webpage, but for a couple of bucks on another webpage, I was able to find out her address. And then I was faced with the question, do I send Lucia a copy of the novel? I mean, the past can trespass on the present, stir up ghostly what-ifs, arouse emotions best left undisturbed, and trump the serenity of the present. As it's always present, as it's always complicated, reconnecting with ex-lovers. Lucia obviously had at least one child, probably more, judging by her reference to the birth of her first child. I certainly did not want her to think I was attempting to rekindle anything by sending her my novel. I mean, a happily married man I am. And most likely, she would be as well a happily married woman. She certainly looked assured and bright and very much what I would call Lucia's spirited in the photograph. In my eyes, looking at her image, she was exactly who I knew that summer, only older. Had I been able to find her telephone number online, I would have called her to tell her first about the novel before sending it, with an explanation that it is creative Irish fiction. That, yes, much exaggeration and bravado add a certain cachet to life, and I had certainly punched things up in my recapitulation of events. That, yes, much of the story of Lucy and Eddie is true, but that just as much of the story is pure fiction. And one never knows how someone living will react to what a storytelling novelist says about them. Still, I knew that Lucy should certainly have an opportunity to read it, no matter how unautobiographical it be. I wrapped the assigned first edition in plain brown paper and mailed it, along with a note wherein I let her know I hope she wouldn't take offense at my portrayal of her. As I've said, you never know how someone's going to take to a writer's slant on them. Now, about 10 days after sending East my novel, I get an email from someone I had never met and whose name I did not recognize in the sent from line. The text of the email read something like this. I don't know who you are, Mr. Edwin Forrest Ward in Denver. We've never met or even knew of each other's existence, but I am writing to thank you so much for helping to remind my mother just how wonderful she is. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I love the book. My mother likewise. Even my grandmother loved it. Ciao, Pia, Lucia's oldest daughter. And then a week or so later, Lucy, as she now prefers to call herself, is on my office phone. After an exchange of greetings, it is 1974 all over again. In that moment of the new millennium, I am 25, not 55, and our comments to each other are as intimate as ever. We are still very much interested in what the other knows. She is still very much the woman who could hitchhike a ride to anywhere, and I am very much the man who made of her a muse. Indeed, we are not ghosts. Lucy's major comment on my novel was that she had read it more than once from start to finish, and now she no longer knew what was fact and what was fiction. She asked me, did I really see a bear? And stated that she could not believe that she'd followed my suggestion and thrown away her diaphragm. The story of my novel had replaced her memory of events. I tell her, no, you never saw a bear. That scene in the novel is of something that happened to me and my wife years later. You and I did not see a mother bear and cub on Lavenir's Pass. And it was my wife who threw away her birth control. But Eddie, she tells me, I can see her, the sow, right now, even though my eyes are closed. I guess I've always known that what is written down is our collective memory, that words make real the ghosts of our lives and return them to the here and now. Thank you.
That was Ed Ward, your next storyteller. She's a favorite of the show. She's a playwright and a great writer. Please welcome Ellen Graham.
It all began with a piece of misdirected mail, a Hallmark envelope in a pastel shade addressed to the house next door, to Mrs. Robert D. Walker, the return address, Mr. Robert D. Walker, inmate number, et cetera, et cetera, Colorado Department of Corrections. We were new to the neighborhood. We had spent the preceding 13 years in Capitol Hill with a short hiatus in a dumpy duplex over by Manual High School. We moved into our new neighborhood in Minter. It was a street of old people, many of them original owners of the tidy blonde brick 1950s houses. The street was eerily silent. Cars appeared and disappeared from driveways. Sidewalks were magically shoveled. In our old apartment building, we had lived with other people's cooking smells, their thumping house music, their underwear strewn across the laundry room. This letter coming through the mail slot was the first clue as to the inhabitants of this new world. As soon as I realized it was not our letter, I headed for the door. "Where are you going?" my husband asked. "I'm going to go put the letter in the mail slot next door." "Just put it in the mailbox and let the mailman re-deliver it." "But what if today is her birthday? She won't get her birthday card and she'll think that he's forgotten and..." "What if she sees you? We don't want her to know that we know her husband's in jail." "Right." For a while, we lived in the miserable servants' quarters behind a big Victorian house on Downing. A chain-link fence separated our tiny lawn from the alley. One afternoon, as I was sat on our grimy porch, a man came down the alley and sat on the curb, just on the other side of the gate. He looked around, then took down his trousers and shat. I held my breath. He must not know that I saw, because the moment he saw me, his dignity would shatter, and there would be no way we could pretend nothing had happened. But he didn't see me. He did up his trousers and went on his way. My husband was right. Mrs. Robert D. Walker could not know that we knew. I dropped the letter in the mailbox on the corner. Spring came, and people started opening their windows. Next door, I started to see a smiling, youngish woman, Mrs. Robert D. Walker. She was extremely cheerful. She had a gray minivan and two buoyant children, a boy and a girl. On Saturday nights, I could hear her singing by her open window, Christian songs, practicing the same lines over and over again for her Sunday morning solos. Another woman who resembled her, a sister, we thought, came around on weekends with her young son. The kids ran around the yard in the warm weather, blowing bubbles and wailing at each other with lightsabers. Around this time, we received another letter. It was addressed to occupant, but it was no standard piece of junk mail. The address was handwritten, and the letter bore a first-class stamp. Strange. I opened the envelope. It contained a tidy photocopied note. "Attention, occupant of this home. Have you looked at your lawn lately? It's a disgrace the way it looks. Please help to keep the neighborhood nice looking." It was unsigned. I tore open the front door and looked up and down the street, those manicured lawns suddenly menacing with their little tulips planted in straight lines, two by two, like good little soldiers. Couldn't we deal with each other directly? Example. For a while, we lived above a hard-drinking divorcee named Joan. Once her music came on in the middle of the night so loudly our floors vibrated. After a few attempts to get a hold of her, we went down into the basement, found the fuse box marked unit number 3, and turned off the electricity in her apartment. See? Direct. You have a problem with our lawn? Come tell me about it. Or better yet, water it. Groom it. A few days after we received that letter, I saw a furious handwritten note prominently displayed on the windshield of a car down the block. To whoever wrote that anonymous note. The response allowed us how the homeowner had been too busy with the various misfortunes, including a death in her family, to take care of her lawn. So mind your own fucking business, asshole. So, this was how wars were waged in the new neighborhood. Silently, on scratch paper. One evening I was walking home from the light rail station. It was dark and I could see the outline of another pedestrian walking up ahead of me. I was at that awkward point. Do I slow down to maintain a respectful distance, or do I try to pass him? Suddenly the figure turned. It was a man, tallish, fleshy, and unremarkable. "I thought you were a vampire," he said. He smiled, cut across the neighbor's yard, and disappeared into the house. This, I later realized, was Mr. Robert D. Walker. From that moment forward, he made his presence felt. He spent a great deal of time outside, smoking, pacing, bellowing into his cell phone. He owed someone, possibly several people, considerable sums of money, and made call after call seeking donations. "When you need a cigarette, I am the first one to go to the store and buy you a pack." A pause, wherein I'm guessing a loan was refused. "Okay, you've got to live with yourself. No one can do that for you. You have to look at yourself in the mirror." The arguments began as well, loud domestic brawls. Voices rose and fell. When I was out for a walk, I passed the sun, his normally bright face so sad that I almost didn't recognize him. I was out in the garden one afternoon when the daughter came bounding out onto the porch, letting the screen door slam behind her. "Don't you slam my screen door." "What?" "Don't you slam my screen door. You close it again and you do it right this time." "Sorry," I heard her tiny voice, and the door closed again very softly. I thought to myself, "Your screen door, asshole." As far as I could tell, he smoked all day while his wife worked. One morning, as she headed out to the minivan, he shouted after her, "Go make us some money!" I imagined all of her money pouring into the bottomless pit of his debt. Then, as suddenly as he appeared, he disappeared. No more telltale smoke drifting into our window. No more cell phone pledge drives. No more screaming arguments. We received two more pieces of anonymous hate mail about my lawn, each with slightly different but equally damning wording. It felt different this time, knowing we were just one of many victims. One day I looked out the window and saw a strange car parked across the street. You see, I had become sufficiently assimilated to our new neighborhood that I noticed strange cars. A strange man sat in the driver's seat. In the passenger seat sat Robert D. Walker, smoking, looking at the neighbor's house. They sat there for at least half an hour before rolling away. I told my husband, "She needs to tell us what the hell is going on over there before something terrible happens." When we lived in the dumpy duplex near Manuel, someone knocked on our door once after 10 p.m. It was a black teenage boy. He asked to use our phone. We handed him the phone and he sat on the front porch and dialed while we sat in the living room listening through the screen door. His side of the conversation was something like this. "Hi." "Yes." "Okay, the neighbors." Finally, after a particularly long pause, he said, "I can't do that. They're white people." What was sufficiently urgent that he knocked on our door that night? What was sufficiently taboo that he couldn't ask us for it? What if some night Mrs. Robert D. Walker knocked on our door? Could she tell me what she needed? Would we do it? A few days later, I was in the kitchen and I saw someone walk by right outside our window. It was a cop, too, actually, walking around the side of the neighbor's house, shining their flashlights into the window. This was it. Something terrible had finally happened. Mrs. Robert D. Walker slumped against the kitchen wall, crumpled at the bottom of the stairs. Recall Joan, the drunk divorcee with the excessively loud music. The first time her music came on in the middle of the night, I became convinced that she was in her apartment. I could picture her in a torn negligee in the bathtub, drowned, her wine glass shattered on the tile where it had fallen from her dead hand. I called her repeatedly, no answer. I pounded at the door, no answer. The next day, when I was on my way to work, the music was still blasting, so I called the cops. They arrived, knocked, then broke into the apartment. It was empty. The cops turned off the stereo. In this case, too, nothing terrible had happened. Crouching in the living room, peering through the blinds, I could see Mr. Robert D. Walker emerge from the back of the police car. I heard the cop say, "You can't go in there unless she's here. Did you call her?" "But I need my stuff." "Next time, you need to call her and make an appointment." They all piled back into the squad car and pulled away. A very long period of quiet followed. When I saw the neighbor next, she commented on how big our son was getting and said she had been incredibly busy with work and church and choir. In November, a for-rent sign appeared next door. A futon, some random tables and housewares materialized in the lawn, marked for Goodwill. But before the truck could come pick the stuff up, everything disappeared, carted away by car, bicycle, and skateboard by the resourceful immigrant families who live in the big apartment buildings a few blocks away. Then Mrs. Robert D. Walker and the kids loaded up a U-Haul and they drove away. A few days later, the for-rent sign was gone and the familiar gray minivan reappeared. And so did Robert D. Walker, and now most mornings the sister-in-law is there too. No sign of the missus, no sign of the kids. We saw the sister on Christmas morning and she said, "Merry Christmas." We saw Robert D. Walker on New Year's Day and he said, "Happy New Year." Whenever bizarre deal was brokered, peace reigns next door. I have a confession. I made up the name Robert D. Walker, not to protect anyone's privacy, but because I don't remember the name that I read off that misdirected envelope, and I never shook the hands of anyone who lived in that house. I know there were fights and debts and jail time served, but I don't know their names. That's how it works. You move in among others, you avert your eyes, but you listen carefully. You scratch lines in the turf, but sometimes you cross them. You cross them because you're curious. You cross them because you fear for someone else's safety or for your own. You cross them because you worry your property values might decline or because you feel certain you will go crazy if you have to listen to that music for one more second. We tore out our lawn and replaced it with shredded bark and cacti. We have received no more anonymous hate mail because by now it should be clear to anonymous that we are beyond redemption. By and large, we are living. We are letting live for now. Thanks.
That's Alan Graham. Your next storyteller, this is his first time ever doing the show. He runs a comedy show at a restaurant called El Chorrito. Please welcome Nick Gossert.
Hey there, folks. My name's Nick Gossert, and 2 years ago, I made a movie. Little independent, low-budget horror flick called The Future Belongs to Undead Gods. And here's a little thing. When you're making a low-budget film, you don't have enough money to do things right, so you're going to break some rules, probably commit some crimes. Nothing bad, I hope. You know, hopefully you're not dumping a dead stuntman in the woods where everybody makes a vow not to talk about it until his ghost comes back for revenge. Hopefully it's just because, you know, you don't have enough money to get permits. You don't have enough money to, you know, in time to wait for building owners to get back to you before you shoot in front of them. Little things like that. And another thing you may not know is underneath the Cherry Creek Mall, there is a vast series of tunnels. Old storehouses and warehouses for all the shops there. So it's just probably about a quarter mile of tunnels and empty rooms, an old service elevator, the remnants of a 1990s dance club that was owned by a Bronco whose name I do not remember. In other words, a perfect movie set. And if I wanted to shoot there properly, I would have contacted the mall, had the board weigh in on things, yay or nay, whether they wanted me or not, and then I would have had to pay a security guard probably $20 an hour to babysit us while we were down there. Not my style. We didn't have the time or money for this. I work in a store at the Cherry Creek Mall. We have access to those tunnels. Day of the scheduled shoot, we brought everybody to the mall, popped the door open, went down there, set up, and just hoped security would not come down. And it's not like we were shooting some little independent drama or some arty thing. No, this is horror, and this is weird horror at that. Yeah, believe it or not, the guy wearing the Cannibal Holocaust shirt did not make a classy movie. And, you know, we get down there, and we set things up. I have a camera. I have lights. I have my pal Jordan Dahl wearing, like, this heavy coat with a gas mask, a helmet, a fake M16. Exactly what any security guard wants to see when he goes downstairs. I have a girl with a ball gag in her mouth and a sexy leather outfit. And in case you're wondering, no, I am not going to explain the scene in context of the film. You're just going to have to see it someday. Well, we set things up. And like I said, the security, we don't have permission to be there. And they do rounds. Every hour or two, they come down, check things out. My plan is, should they show up, we run into one of the dark rooms, turn off the lights, and hope for the best. Great backup plan. So we get shooting, we shoot all this weirdness, we're with everybody walking down the hallway, Jordan Dahl with a machine gun and a gas mask, girl with a ball gag in her mouth, guy who's the president of the future explaining what he wants done with the prisoners. Like I said, classy picture. That does pretty well. Finally, we get to the next part of the scene where the main guy goes into the next room, turns on the light, where we've got the naked 20-year-old tied in a doorway like this, where he goes up, says some rather dirty things, unmuts his shirt, monster comes out of his chest, grabs onto a boobie, starts breastfeeding while milk pours all over the place. This actress, for some reason, brought along one of her friends from Colorado Springs, and I don't even know why. I don't know if she was trying to show off, like, the glamours of show business. If that's what she thought, she did it wrong. So we have her in this room, naked, tied up, her friend wondering why she's there, camera, lights, you know, my pal Nate Balding just taking photos and giggling, and, you know, we're getting all this stuff shot, and that's when we hear footsteps coming down the stairs. Well, like I said, plan B, we shut off the lights, push everybody against the wall, naked girl still tied into a door frame, because let's face it, we cannot do that very quick, and we're just sitting there in the dark looking at each other, waiting for some poor fucking mall cop to walk by and hopefully not look right at the last minute. And I sat there and I wondered, what are we going to do if he does? Like, what happens if he sees the movement, turns around, flips on the light, and sees this clusterfuck of weirdness? Like, or am I going to try to talk my way out of it? Am I going to try to explain myself? Am I just going to be stoic and, like, take the trespassing ticket? Are we going to overreact and, like, hog tie him, finish the shoot, and leave him down there? I would just hope he would just turn on the light, see all this monster puppet sticking out of a guy's chest, naked girl tied up, camera crew, and just go, I'm not filling out this paperwork. Turns the light back on, keeps walking. Fortunate for us, fortunate for me, nobody looked. He just kind of just walked on by, went back up the other stairs, disappeared out the other side of the tunnel, and we finished our scene. Here's another little thing when you're shooting an independent film. People are going to quit on you. You're not paying people, or you're not paying people well, and all you can really do is hope the people who quit are not that important. And I had lost my special effects girl. Fine, I'm a special effects person myself. Keep on going. So I didn't get to be the objective director for this is one, like pretty much our last big scene of the film. Back in the corner, you know, the camera set up, lights, Nate Balding giggling, girl tied up, and I'm running this tubing, running from behind a guy, up around, through this puppet that I'm controlling with its arms, little animatronic thing, while it's holding onto this 20-year-old girl who's just made a bad life decision's breasts. Let's face it, if you're in a movie I'm directing, you've made a bad call. And he's just holding on to, the little monster's holding on to the boobs. I've got two meat syringes full of heavy whipping cream, room temperature. So as soon as it latches on, I press them both. It's like grabbing hold of this. It's just spraying out of its mouth in every direction. And I didn't get to see it objectively, but I think I got to the best feedback I ever could when I look over and the camera operator's doing this. Fortunately, he was still framed up right, no matter how full of disgust he was. And we finished up the film, and that's getting close to a year ago at this point. And here's the other thing with independent film. There's no money, no time, no way to do it right. You have so many things to fix in post-production that it just takes forever. You're going to spend very little time doing it. So more or less, when you're doing post-production on a low-budget horror film, it's like you're the father of a bastard child. Like, you've had an illegitimate kid, and you just work long hours at a crappy job that you don't really enjoy. But it's all worth it, because you're paying for this. And now the weekends, you get to spend a few hours with it. You're not exactly tossing around the old football, but it's still, you know, it's quality time. It makes you feel like you're doing something good, something important to you. It makes you feel like you're not totally screwing everything up in your life. And it kind of makes it a little worthwhile. But it makes the rest of the time pretty crappy. But fortunately for me, I work at this place, so whenever I'm feeling bad, feel like it's taking too long, feeling like I'm not making a whole lot of progress in things, I can go down those stairs, walk down the hall, flip on the light, and see this horrifying curdled stain of heavy whipped cream that's still there to this day, just stinking the place up. And I can feel good about myself. And that gets me through the time. That's more or less my story. A little bit quicker than I expected. My name's Nick Osser. Thank you for listening, and thank you for Andrew for letting me tell it.
That was Nick Osser.
All right, your next storyteller. She is a comedian and a member of Denver's newest comedy group called Lady Face, which is an all-female sketch comedy group, which is awesome. Next time we do a show, you should come see it. Please welcome Melanie Carnop.
All right, Trespass. Awesome. Thanks, Andrew. I haven't done homework in a long time. I thought maybe I would tell you a story about a time when I was a teenager and I TP'd this guy's house like 3 nights out of 4 and ran away from the cops with my Birkenstocks and almost took it away, but I don't want you to know that about me. So here we go, trespass. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Those you good, practiced, and learned Christians know that's part of the Lord's Prayer. For the rest of you, you're going to hell. No, I'm kidding. You're not. I'm not trying to sermonize you. I just think that's a really good quote. And I think for every action on the planet, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And when it comes to a trespass, it's not another trespass. It's not. It's forgiveness. Forgiveness is its equal and usually greater reaction. There's many different kinds of trespasses that you can have. There's simple ones, like just wandering across some farmer's field, not meaning to. You're obviously on their land. That's a trespass. I think that you can let that go. There's really intense forms of trespass, such as 9/11, where I don't know that most humans have the ability to forgive an act like that. And there's a sweet and easy to forgive trespass, like my nephew Carter, who just came into my life less than a month ago. And he's a baby. He's changed my life. It's not even mine. And he's going to be a part of my life for the rest of my life. And I can forgive him because it's a bundle of joy. And I get to have that. And then in my life, another one that's difficult to forgive would be like Columbine, especially close to home in Colorado. I try to speak about Columbine often because I feel like the more that we can talk things out, like this particular show, the more that we can learn and grow beyond the things that have happened to us. I hope someday that we are able to grow beyond that one. This is my personal worst trespass, and it was against me and not by me. When I was 5 years old, two neighbors decided to trespass against me, mind, body, and soul. And I was left with no other decision other than to continue that trespass against myself throughout my life. It lowered my personal value of myself, questioned my integrity on this planet, questioned everything that ever came into my path. And my parents got to watch me grow up and do unhealthy things and not understand why my torment existed. I ate to fill the hole in my soul, and I grew to a size where nobody would want me, and I kind of did that on purpose. And as I came to the age of hormones and I decided that I wanted to go out there and aggress myself, I took kind of the reaction, I don't know, this is like an absurd comparison, but in The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy is wandering down the yellow brick road and she decides she's hungry, and she picks an apple, and the tree gets pissed off. It's like, you want that apple? Fine, here, take a bunch of apples. I guess I'm kind of that tree. You want that apple? Fine, take all my apples, see if I give a shit. And the truth is that over time I became my own worst enemy. I spent my life bent on achieving things, on excelling and proving my worth to everybody but myself, to no avail, and as my own worst enemy. This is a quote by Johann Caspar Lavater, a Swiss theologian. He who cannot forgive a trespass of malice to his enemy has never yet tasted the most sublime enjoyment of love. So even though I am my own worst enemy, the circumstances that I was given on this planet has pushed me forward beyond what I think most people go during the day. I went through music school, and now you should come check out my band later tonight. I tell jokes, because I'm not afraid to get on stage and make a fool of myself, because I have felt much more the fool alone in a dark room. And I can get up on the stage and share that story with you, even though I really didn't want to. But the truth is that over time, like, I have forgiven myself, and I have forgiven those who trespassed against me, because it's the only way to live life to its fullest. And I can tell you now that I really do love my life. And I'll leave you with this quote from the prophet, which if you haven't read it, you should. Then a woman said, "Speak to us of joy and sorrow." And he answered, "Your joy is your sorrow unmasked. and the selfsame well from which your laughter rises was oftentimes filled with your tears. And how else can it be? The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Thank you.
That was Melanie Carnap, your next storyteller. He's a special guest from out of town. He spends his time in New York and Los Angeles. I don't know where he's living now, but he lives between those two places. And he's originally from Baltimore, Maryland. Please welcome a very talented comedian, Matt Betts.
Thanks, guys. It's good to be here. I've never done a show quite like this before. Usually it's about just coming up and doing dick jokes, so this would be nice to access a different part of my heart. Because most of my heart is just dick jokes, apparently. That was fucking deep, right, man? Oh, shit. This story about trespassing is called Trespass. We were standing on the beach, staring up at the lights that had just come on inside the house that we were illegally camping under. Oh yeah, and we were tripping on acid. About 6 hours earlier, we were at this party. Well, we were at our party, your typical keg party in Tallahassee, Florida. Young college kids, guys in baseball caps, girls not wearing very much. But for five of us, this wasn't good enough. My friend Alan pulled out a baggie of Teddy Grahams. Yeah, Teddy Grahams, like the snacks you can buy in your snack aisle. I don't remember what flavor they were, cinnamon, honey. All I know is they were dipped with liquid acid, which is, I guess the guy we used to buy them from thought that that was an easier way to transport them. You could have a baggie of those and just go right into a fucking school and be like, hey, here we go. it was important at that point not to eat a handful of these things, I think, is the take-home message. But so we're at a party at our house, three guys and two girls, and it was a keg party. And then we all of a sudden realized that wasn't good enough for us. We want to leave our own party, and we had all these people there. And the bag of Teddy Grahams was slowly disappearing. And everyone was being drunk, and the five of us just wanted to walk, if you've ever taken acid before. It's one of those drugs where, like, as long as you're outside, you're having a good time, you know? Like, everything else is fine. So, and someone, and I forget who threw out the idea, they were like, let's go to Panama City Beach, which is only about 2 hours from Tallahassee, not even that far. Yeah, and you're on acid, so that's not going to take long at all, right? And then my friend Alan, he sprung upright in his chair, and you could tell, like, he had one of those ideas that makes you sit up but not tell people right away. He wanted to savor what he was, this bomb he was about to drop on the rest of us. And he was like, my friend owns a house in Panama City Beach. We could go camp out on the beach. Awesome. The ocean, the sand, the sky, these are things, you know, that make acid fun. If you really want to define what an acid trip is like, I'd say it's one of those things that make you say, you know, now I realize we should enjoy all this stuff that we usually take for granted. Like, that's acid. But I digress. I actually even wrote that. In case I forgot to digress, I would remind myself, this is where you're supposed to digress. Nice job, man. So the problem was, is we still had this house full of people. So we asked them to leave, and no one wanted to go. So then we pretended that someone stole the keg. We actually tried to pick up the keg while people were drinking around it and move it away from all the people drinking. Five people on acid, we were carrying it away from them like, they're not going to see us. It's fine. Shh. This isn't the keg you're looking for. In reality, we just moved it to the side of the house. We didn't get it very far. And ultimately, one of our friends was like, we'll take care of your house, just leave. And apparently that was good enough. We were just, yeah, fine. We'll just take care of our house, other drunk people. And at this point, we were all tripping pretty hard, and so we decided to take two cars to Panama City. Which, to this day, I just remember taking two cars for five people and having no idea why we were like, let's get two drivers out there. Come on. So we drive down there to Panama City, and when we arrived, it was dark. It was probably 2 o'clock in the morning by this point. And I'm not even sure if we were at the right house. Like, none of us knew these people, but Alan assured us. He's like, it was his friend's parents' house. And we're like, whoa, 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 whoa. You said it was your friend's house. No, look, I was in this guy's wedding, and this is his parents' house. Wait a second, you were just in his wedding? Like, how close of a friend, like... I mean, I've been to people's weddings before. I don't even like them. They just need people because they're older and they don't have enough friends anymore to fill out a groom party, you know? Are they here? I don't know. It looks empty. Should we knock? It's amazing how every statement at the time seemed like really well-intentioned, but now it seems more idiotic every time I think about it. Should we knock? Are you serious? Like, if we had walked up to their door and been like, we're just going to be... right down here. Did you guys bring any food with you? Yeah, we got a bag of Teddy Grahams. Just the two tents. That's what we got. That's what we're rolling with. So we grabbed our tents. We walked down to the beach. It's completely dark out, you know. Alan and our friend Beth were kind of seeing each other at the time, so they immediately went into one tent and started just doing whatever they do. And, whatever kids do. And Courtney and Abby and I were on the beach smoking a joint. We're looking up at the stars. We're just in heaven, you know. And we decided to take a walk, and we ended up at one of these concrete barriers that you run into on the beach where it's like just the end of the beach, basically, and it juts out into the ocean, and then it takes a sharp right. It was basically like a resort, kind of like the Breakers. You know, they're protected by this big concrete wall. So we were like, well, we'll just walk around the edge of the wall out into the ocean and keep going that way. Around the wall. So we walk out, take a right, so we're 25 feet out into the ocean and then against this concrete wall where waves are just crashing up against it. We made it probably another 15 feet before one of us, thank God, was like, this is not where we need to be at all. We should head back. As we're walking back, something caught our eye. A light from yonder window breaks. It is the east, and the people renting the house are awake and looking outside. The funny thing is I don't remember rushing at this point. I remember grabbing the tents and not taking the tent poles out and shoving them into the back of the car. But I never remember rushing. It was very, all right, let's take our time. Everything's fine. I wish I could tell you that we had some crazy altercation with these renters, you know. We just got in our cars, drove to the Waffle Shack. This is not a typo. We weren't at a Waffle House. We found a Waffle Shack. Where Abby and Beth serenaded the truckers and the Waffle Shack waitresses with that song. Oh, honey, ah, sugar, sugar. You have to picture two barefoot girls at 5 o'clock in the morning on acid and a trucker with, like, a Wine'em Dine'em 69'em hat on and just, like, the two of them and us just sitting there like, yeah, this is what we're doing. On my way home, I distinctly remember Abby and Courtney waking me up so I could hit a joint and then pass right back out again. And it always makes me laugh that we never thought we were trespassing until those lights came on. In both a literal and a figurative sense. Thank you guys very much. How are you doing?
That's Matt Betts.
This next comedian, this is his first time doing the show. He's a very talented comedian that I've known my entire comedy career. Please welcome Mike Shervin.
Thank you. My story is not so much about a time when I was actually trespassing. I was supposed to be there, but it felt very much like I should not be there. When I was in college, I went to CSU, up at Fort Collins. One summer, I worked for a property management company. And for the most part, my job was I did like lights landscaping at commercial properties. You know, like at King Supers, it has like grass out front that I mow and trim bushes, pull weeds. That was basically my job. One day, I got into work, and my boss is like, "Hey, just hop in your car, follow me. We're gonna take the truck out. You're doing something different today, and I'll explain it when we get there." So I follow my boss. He parks in this alley behind this building. Basement of this building, or the main floor of this building, it's a restaurant that's empty. It's completely deserted. We walk up the fire escape to the second floor, and it's me, my boss, one other guy that I worked with. His name was Tim. Boss opens up the door, and the smell that just comes out, it's like dead animal food, gross vomit. That's the smell that comes out when he opens the door. It's horrible smell. And we walk in, and what it is, it's apartments, sort of. One long hallway and apartments on either side. My boss goes, "All right, what you're going to be doing, we are renovating this building. And I need you to clean out as much of the stuff from these apartments. Everybody's been evicted. I just need you to take everything out. We're going to leave the truck. Bag everything you can. Just toss it in the truck. It's all going to the dump." And he said, "Tim is coming with me for most of the morning. He's got some other stuff to do, so you're going to be working by yourself most of the time. And just do what you can. Do the best you can today. Work as fast as you can, because after tomorrow, we can't be here for 3 days." And I said, "Well, what's tomorrow?" He said, "Well, tomorrow the spiritual cleansers come, and then after they're here, nobody can come in or out for 3 days. And I kind of stood there for a second. Spiritual cleansers? He's like, "Yeah, yeah. Like an exorcist? Yeah, sure." I was like, "Okay." And I didn't know how to process that. I didn't know the answer. I didn't know what was next to say there. And he was basically like, "Well, Tim and I are going to go. Just like I said, do your best." And he's gone. And so suddenly I'm in a building by myself that I was just told is going to be exorcised the next day. And, he did give us a quick tour around, and, you know, he showed us one place. He "You see the ceiling tiles pulled out there? That's where they kept the drugs. This was, like, the major stash house of the drug dealers. And there was, like, toys all over the floor." And I'm just like, did they keep the drugs, or were there kids here? They're probably a little bit of both. Like, they stored drugs and toys, and kids were here. And it was like, sad. It was awful. And so I didn't have anything else to do. I got to work. And the first apartment I go to is I walk in, and they're not apartments. They're not like they're shitty. They're just awful. They're one room with like a tiny, has a little fridge and a little stove, and that's it. And then the rest is a bedroom. No bathroom in any of the units. It was, the bathroom was at the end of the hall. That was it. So I get to work, and the first one I'm in, it's magazines. From wall to wall, magazines. It's about that deep. And they're all in magazines from the 80s, the Time, Newsweek, all that shit. I just throw them in a box, and I keep dumping the box over into the truck. I found like a ton of wrappers of Playboys. I don't know if you guys have gotten Playboy via mail, but they don't just mail you the magazine. It's a little plastic wrapper, so I guess the postman can't look. And I was bummed. I was bummed that I didn't find any Playboys, because, you know, no matter how creeped out you are or how weirded out you are by a situation, pornography makes it better. It's a nice thing. So that one takes me a little while. I get that one cleared out. And then I go to another one, and I'm like, "Oh, these people must have moved out most of their stuff. It's probably good. It's just a mattress and a tub of clothes. That one's easy. I just toss the big-ass mattress over, and then through the, and everything was nasty." And then it didn't dawn on me till later. I was like, that was probably all that they owned. It's not like they moved everything else out. That's probably it for what they had. So I go into the third one, and I open up the door, and this was a bedroom. This had a bed that had sheets on it, and it had a dresser, clothes in the dresser, and stuff on the dresser. You know, like I just dump out my pockets every night. That's what the top of the dresser looked like. And there were pictures. There's a little mirror with pictures tucked in. And immediately I felt like this is somebody's house. This is where somebody lived. I shouldn't be here. I'm not allowed to be here. This isn't right. I have to go. And I close the door. I just like, I can't be in here. I can't do this. So I close that door. Started working in another room. One of the things I forgot to mention is, you know, with the smell, it smelled so bad, I left the doors open. I left the front door and the back door of the hallway open. Get a little breeze going, so it kind of aired it out a little bit. A good 3 hours into the day, a gust of wind kicks up and slams one of the doors shut. And I've heard people say, oh, I almost shit my pants, I was so scared. I thought that was kind of a figure of speech. But I came really close to the actual. That was like the closest. There was like, oh, okay, we're okay. We're okay. But it was pretty damn close. And after that, I made sure I took huge things to prop up the doors after that. And so, you know, just a complete day of complete uneasiness. It just sucked. You know, I just felt shitty being there. You know, I'm just throwing out people's stuff. And then this guy, Tim, eventually he came back. And he's like, how's things going? And I'm like, oh, it's going all right. He's like, hey, did you find any Playboys in that room? I was like, no, I did not. He's unfazed by it. He doesn't care at all. He opens the door that I had left closed, and he's like, oh, a lot of stuff in here. We gotta get going on this one. I'll start in here. So he starts in there. He's gathering up all the shit. And 15 minutes goes by. I hear from down the hall, I hear, hey, found the Playboys. So go down there. Yeah, of course I want to look. We start flipping through the Playboys, and they're old Playboys. The pubic hair was unkempt. You know it's an old Playboy when because nowadays it's either completely gone or like a little perfectly trimmed line. It wasn't in the 80s. They kind of left it unkempt. It was about that old. So we're flipping through that, and Tim looks at me. He's like, you know, any of the stuff we could find here, any of the stuff we can just keep it if you want. I'm like, what? Any of this, if you want any of this, just take it home. It's just going to go to the dump anyway. Just take it. I'm going to take some of these shirts. I'm just going to wash them. They'll be fine. I'm like, I don't want any of this. And he's just like, no, seriously, you need to take something. And he's just, for me, it was like stealing. It was like still somebody lived there. They could have come back at any minute. It was too real for me. I just couldn't do it. I don't want to take somebody's stuff. And then he gets belligerent about it. Like, almost I'm saying I'm too good for it. Like, he's thinking, well, you don't want any of this shit? I'm taking it. I don't care. So he gets a little bit belligerent about it. So I said, fine. I found this box, and it was full of 8-tracks. It was 8-tracks. It was Elvis and Beatles 8-tracks. I was like, oh, Elvis and Beatles vinyl would be worth money. Maybe this will be worth, I don't know. So I grabbed this box. I said, I'll take this. I put it in the trunk of my car. And then we got done for that day. We did a decent job. He left. I never ended up going back there. What happened was they did the spiritual cleansing as per planned. Then the 3 days, then the weekend hit. And then the next week was a huge flood in Fort Collins. I don't know if you know, remember Fort Collins flood. But so the rest of the time I worked for the company, I worked outdoors, I was cleaned up after the flood. But what happened was I had this box of 8-tracks in my car. I don't have a major ending to this story. But what happened was I go home for a couple weeks before school started. And I'm hanging out with my mom. My engine on my car blew. And so I just left it there. I had to get a ride back to school with my dad. My mom tries to sell my car. Some guy offers $250 for it, so we take it. It has no engine anyway. So we take the $250. My mom's cleaning up. She's like, I found a bunch of 8-tracks in the trunk. She's like, did you need those? I was like, no, you can throw those away. So I end up back at Fort Collins. One morning, last morning before I'm supposed to leave this house that I've been subletting a room all this summer. Two guys that were on the lease were gone camping. Somebody's pounding on the door. They're like, we're with a property management company. You guys are out of here today. You guys need to be gone. It's like, oh, shit. The other two guys, they're not here. And they're like, well, okay. Well, we need to clear everything out. So you have, like, till noon to leave. Luckily, I knew a guy that had a truck. He came over, loaded all my shit. I was able to hang it out at his house until I was able to move into my new house. Scrawled my new phone number on the counter for these guys. They eventually came back. They called me. They said, did you take any of our stuff, like our backpacks or our pots and pans and stuff like that? I was like, no. And he's like, man, I bet the property management company just threw it away. I was like, yeah, they probably did. So, like I said, I don't have a huge life lesson learned. Although I did see bottom. That you know, I've seen homeless people. To me, it's still like kind of distant. But this was seeing somebody's bottom, you know. And for a while I was very much always say no after that. I was like, if that's how drugs end up, I'm not going there. But it just was the strangest day I've ever worked in my life. And after that, I think it just stuck with me, and I think it scared me to the point where I'm like, work hard, bastard, because that's how people live sometimes. All right, that's going to be it for me. Thank you.
Mike Sherman. You guys are such an awesome crowd. We have a few more storytellers left, and then, and then that's the end of the show. I don't know why I faded out there. That's what happens after the straight does. And then we're going to have a dance party. We clear the tables away. Your next storyteller, she's a comedian I'd love to watch. She's also part of that Lady Face group. Also very funny sketch actress. Please welcome Kristen Rand.
How are you guys doing tonight, huh? Happy New Year. I was going to bring up notes, and I was like, you know what? I'm just going to fucking get up here and storytell. I'm going to tell stories of truth. I'm a stand-up, so I don't talk into that thing. One time I trespassed in the 15th story of this building with this friend of mine, my senior year of college, and they were, like, doing construction, and the sun was setting. It was gorgeous, and we fucked on this desk. I'm just kidding, that's not the story I'm going to tell, but that would be a really good story. And he calls me all the time, and he's just like, oh, remember that time? That's my teacher now. We fucked on his teacher's desk. Okay. Let's go back in a time machine, before we heard Melanie's theme of exactly what the fuck I'm about to do. We did not do this together, but when I heard the theme of trespass, I thought, first of all, thanks for that theme. Because that's totally easy, right? Because there's been love and hurt and trespass. And the first thing I think of, anyone else who was raised Catholic, was holding hands in Mass and saying, forgive those who have trespassed against us, right? And forgive us our trespasses. And it that's the first thing I thought was, so that's what I'm going to go with, guys. And when I went to church, which was every Sunday my entire life growing up, I sat next to my dad because he was the guy that I could always, like, nudge and be like, look at what a fag the priest looks like today. And he was always my go-to guy for, like, any kind of joking around during church where my mom thought, like, me doing that might as well be 69ing, you know, the altar boys. It was, like, equivalent. It was the same fucking thing. She did it, like, she was super strict and she's so into her faith, so I always knew my dad. Go-to guy. And my dad, basically, my whole life was, like, my best friend. He was my everything. He was, like, the epitome of what, like, a guy should be. He was, like, the Seinfeld to my Elaine, you know what I mean? BFF to the core. He would stay up on Saturday nights and watch Saturday Night Live with me, like, when Chris Kattan was Mango. Do you guys remember that? That's when I would watch SNL with my dad. He was my softball coach when he had two sons. I think he knew where the talent was, am I right? I don't know why he did that, even looking back in retrospect, why he chose to do that for me. He was really the greatest dad. He would go on business trips all the time, but always bring back shower caps from the hotels he stayed in, and I thought that was the greatest thing that ever existed. Basically, I idolized my father, and I don't know if any girls grew up doing that, just thinking your dad, because I studied psychology, and really, your dad is the first example to you of what a man is, what a man should be, and, like, he was the fucking best. He was, like, the greatest dad ever. And then when I was 16, I woke up one morning, and my mom was making French toast, and I learned later that was what he requested for his last meal with the family be. And he told us all, ugh. Not so much in that voice. Maybe like a more grown up, ugh. I'm in love with my secretary and I'm moving out. And it was like the most insanely painful, heart-wrenching. Like, I even remember what I was wearing because of that, like, sense memory. It was like this little white nightgown that totally showed my 16-year-old titties to all my brother's friends when I was washing my face in the sink. And I remember that day, like, so clearly. And that whole, I mean, because they still had, they slept in the same bed that entire, like, no one had even known, but I should have fucking suspected something because my grandmother was in town, and it was in the middle of July, and it was, like, nobody's birthday. It wasn't Christmas. Why the fuck are you here, Grandma? I learned later it was to go with my mom to my dad's office and snoop through his shit and find out what the fuck he was up to. My fucking 68-year-old grandma. I love it. She's a badass. So, don't worry about it, guys. So my dad ended up moving out that day, and it was like seriously the most traumatic, horrible trespass that had ever happened to me. And in retrospect, I look back and I'm like, absolutely, the first guy that ever broke my heart was my father. Like, the first guy that ever destroyed everything that I held as a foundation of truth and what I wanted was completely destroyed, and my dad did that to me. And I was so mad at him. I didn't talk to him for, like, at least the first year at all. I was like, fuck you, Dad, I'm fine. Look at me, best actress in the junior year play. Go fuck yourself. I never talked to him. I just wanted him to think that it, like, didn't affect me at all. It wasn't a problem. Matchbox 20 had a new album out. Hit me deep. Like, I was going through a really intense breakup. Like, oh, Dad, bed of lies, I know it. My dad did that to my mom. It hit me so hard, you guys. My parents were married when they were super young. They were 21 and 23 years old. And when I think back about when I, like, what I was doing when I was 21, I don't fucking know or remember at all. So to think about, like, starting a family that young, like, the more I want to be mad at my dad, the more I am so fucking grateful for everything that I had as a child, for everything that he did for me. For I lived, you guys, in a mountain, in a town cradled in a mountain in North Carolina. Like, I grew up with, like, cows in my front yard and horses on my side yard, and I had a sandbox that my dad built for us from scratch. And he read me stories to sleep every night that I can remember till I was, like, 16 years old. And the more I want to be angry and, like, and be mad at him for what he did, for what he took away from me, I can really, like, can't think of anything else to do but thank him for what I did have with him and for what I can, what I am as myself because of him, you know what I mean? And, like, that's what forgiveness is. You don't forgive somebody for them. You forgive somebody for your fucking self so you can live your life and not hold on to shit that hurts you every day. You forgive somebody so that you can have that for yourself. And so, like, I do forgive those who trespass against me. I forgive my dad, the first and worst person. No one can ever hurt me as bad as my dad did. And thinking about it now, I really can't think of anything about my dad that I wouldn't thank him for, because I'm so grateful that he gave me that. So forgive those, you guys, that trespass against you, because your life is going to suck because you don't, not theirs. You feel me? Can I get an amen? Anybody hear me? All right, that was just my opener. I'm going to tell you about this time I snuck into old Mr. Johnston's property, you guys. Haunted house. It was a thing. I'm kidding. Thank you guys so much. Give it up for your host, Andrew Orman, and all the rest of the people tonight. You're a really fucking great crowd.
That's Kristen Rand.
Johnston.
Mr. Johnston. I'm sorry. Old Mr. Johnston. I screwed up the fictional farmer on that one. We do an open theme narrator show every third Thursday where there is no theme. Anybody can just come down, tell a true story. It's slowly building steam, and this guy always comes down and not only does it, but does very well. And he's also a great comedian. Please welcome Kevin O'Brien.
Another big round of applause for Andrew. Everybody's seen tonight. Great, great, great show. So I don't know if you can tell by my Midwestern charm, but I grew up in a very small town in west central Nebraska. And when I grew up, I was really into straight edge punk rock music, and I was an altar boy, and then I moved here for college, and when I went back, I had a Bukowski-esque level drinking problem. Like, it just, this place, I don't know what it is about Denver, but I started boozing really hard. And after my freshman year of college, I had to move back to my hometown in Nebraska, and it was horrifying, because it was like when you get, like, the little, like, ball in the cup toy, and you're like, well, this is fine. If you only have the ball in the cup toy, you don't know any different. And then somebody gives you an Xbox Kinect, and you're like, this is the best thing ever! And then 9 months later, they give you the ball and cup toy again. So, of course, I just filled it up with liquor and just started doing that, just shots all the time. I moved back to my hometown, and I got a job as an assistant manager at a children's theme park. At 19 years old, moved back into my parents' house. And this is pretty much how every single night of the entire summer went. We'd get off at 11 o'clock at night. At 11:15, my friend Corey is my best friend. We both were assistant managers together at this children's theme park. Pick me up, and then we'd drive around for about 20 minutes and do a Hey Mister. You guys know what a Hey Mister is? Alright, I'm the only guy who grew up in a small town, didn't have a good fake ID. A Hey Mister is when you go, in our case, to a Quick Stop, and you see a guy that looks just one parole violation away from being in prison forever, and then you say, Hey Mister, can you buy us some beer? And they always say yes. If you're discerning enough, they always say yes, but then you have to get in this interaction. Hey, Missy, buy us some beer. Saunters over. You're not a cop, are you? No, we're not cops. We don't even have facial hair. How the fuck can we be cops? Well, if you're a cop, you got to tell me. I'm not a cop. Okay, give them $20. Get 1 6-pack of beer. That's how it went for the entire summer. And but that wasn't the hardest part. That was relatively easy. But drinking in my hometown when I was underage, the hardest part was finding somewhere to drink. Because I was still underage. My parents didn't even know that I drank this entire time. They just thought I was really tired from how hard I was working at the kids' theme park, bringing joy to the youth of North Platte, Nebraska. And we would have to just, like, I wasn't down with drinking in a car. He wasn't down with drinking in a car. Neither one of us wanted to get DUIs. So we would just have to find weird dudes' trailers to drink in, just the two of us. And we did this a lot, and there's this one night in particular where my buddy Corey and I got split up. Like, he had something going on, so I was on my own, and I was hanging out with these people I went to high school with, and they're like, we can't get any booze, you know, we're going to get some booze. Like, no, let's go to Northside, let's do a Hey Mister. I got this on lock. I live in Colorado. I know how things work now, all right? And we go and do a Hey Mister. And I was like, oh, man, where the hell are we going to find somewhere to drink all this beer? And this girl says, oh, my God, my mom is selling our old house, and I have the key to the house. So we can go into this abandoned house and just drink all night. And I was like, awesome. I need a good excuse to tell my dad because I got to work at 10 o'clock in the morning. So I go back home real quick. It's like, oh, I'm going camping out at the lake. I'm just going to go camping. Yeah, you know, just a nice, robust camp session at 12:45 in the morning, and I grab a tent out of the garage, and we go to the house, and the girl's key doesn't work, because it's like a realty key. I don't know what this is. Like, there's a box above the door jamb and a thing, and I got really close to just being a Neanderthal, just, like, taking a club to it. Like, we gotta drink this fucking beer. And we couldn't get in. We thought the night was ruined, and as we were walking back to the car, there was a garage, and the door was open, and I was like, hey, we could drink in this garage all night, and guess what? I got a fucking tent in the car! So we did what I later coined as urban camping and set up a tent inside of this ramshackle garage drinking Busch Light all night long, and at, like, an hour and a half goes by, and we had already killed all of our Hey Mister beer. And it was like 2:30 in the morning, so we all drive to Walmart because that's the only place in the entire town. I mean, if you've ever been to a small town, Walmart just single-handedly crushed every business around it. It was open for 24 hours. So once again, with my brilliant idea, I was like, let's go to Walmart,
steal a bottle of Southern Comfort. And I didn't do it because I was, a pussy, as they say. And but I sent these girls in to do it, and they walk out, and we got away. We stole a fifth of Southern Comfort after I'm already, really drunk, and we started slamming it. Things get real weird. I make out with a girl that brushed me off in high school. Big revenge. I don't know if you've ever made out with somebody before. I highly recommend it. It's only second to hate fucking somebody, but that's a different story for a different show, I guess. But so I pass out in the tent in the garage, and at 7:30 in the morning, I get woken up by a cop. And not only is it a cop, it is my classmate's dad, who is the chief of police, banging on the door, and I was like, holy shit, it's the fucking cops, so I'm gonna get an MIP! Like, that was at least my problems. And then I hear the girl who I'm laying next to, she doesn't even have her shirt on, and she hears her mom, and she goes, Mom? And then she goes, Jessica, is that you? And she's like, oh my god, Mom! And then her mom tells the cop, Oh no, it's fine, it's my daughter. And the cop just leaves. He just leaves. He's like, oh, alright, it's your shitty kid that pitched a tent in your own garage. And we find out later, the reason that the cops were called is because they thought we were cooking meth in the garage, because they saw there was a house for sale with one dim bulb lit, we were just Clubber Lane working out to take on Rocky and Rocky 3, and they thought we were brewing meth in there the whole night. So when they saw it was just a bunch of drunk teens, they're like, ah, fuck it, we're just out of here, we got better things to do. And so I was like, oh my god, and this girl puts on her shirt, I just pack up the tent. I wasn't in scouts for very long, but I feel like I should get an Eagle Scout badge for how quickly I packed up this tent. And I throw everything together, I go home. Right as my dad's leaving for work, he's walking out the door as I'm walking in, and I'm really drunk, just like, oh, great camping trip. Oh, you're right, I gotta get to work in an hour, Pops. And I put everything away, and I was like, I can lay down for 10 minutes. I'm just gonna take a quick snooze before I gotta sell cotton candy for the next 8 hours. And I laid down. Next thing I know, my alarm is going off as loud as possible. My dad is standing over me yelling at me, and it is 11 o'clock, and I was supposed to be at work an hour ago. And he, I didn't even have time to change. He grabbed me by my shirt, throws me into our minivan, and he drives me to work, and he said, were you drinking last night? And, which is, yes. And I was like, yeah, I was. He goes, you smell like a goddamn brew house! And since I was 19 and really insightful, I said, so what? And then he says, well, I'm worried. I'm going to take you to work, and the park supervisor is going to be there. He's going to give you a drug test. You know what? You're not going to pass, Junior. He's like, I got this. I can do this. And I show up, and I'm ready to just be fired. I had no idea who was going to be there. And I walk in, and the first person I see is my best friend, Corey, the other assistant manager. And there's no real boss around. All the 16-year-olds are prepping up the corn dog roller and everything. And I'm like, oh my god, Corey, I thought I was gonna get fired. I was like, I'm so sorry. By the way, I'm not legally able to drive at this point. I'm so drunk at 11:15 in the morning. I give him a big hug. He's like, oh, I'm so sorry, man. I owe you a million. He's like, oh, don't worry about it. He's like, you smell like booze, though. Seriously, you have to do something. So I run into the bathroom, and the only thing that didn't smell like alcohol in there was a bottle of Brut cologne that had probably been there since 1986. I have no idea how long it's been there, and I just douse myself in it like I'm an 80-year-old guy at some retirement home or something. Like, I feel like I should have been hugging all the kids a little too long. That's how much Brut I put on. And I went and I sat down to start counting the drawer, and I put my head down just so hungover, and I hear somebody go, are you alright, son? I turn over, and it's the park supervisor. No more than 6 minutes after I showed up, and I said, oh yeah, I have the flu really bad in June in Nebraska. And he believed it. He totally bought it. And I got away with it scot-free. And to this day, that guy is still my best friend. He is the coolest. Corey Healy not only saved my life, but also saved my job, and gave me one of the funniest, drunkest stories I've ever been able to tell. So thank you guys so much. My name's Kevin Harvard.
That was Kevin O'Brien. All right, we've reached the last... Kevin O'Brien. The last storyteller of the evening. He's a very talented actor, and I've heard a very talented slam poet, but I've never heard of slam poetry. But I have witnessed his one person acting, and it is amazing. Please welcome the awesome Matt Zambrano.
How's it going?
So there was this. Oh, hey, John. There was this story in the news last week. I don't know how many of you saw this about this elderly couple in Italy who were married for like 75 plus years. The guy's 99, she's 96. He finds out that she had cheated on him in the 1940s, and that day is like, I want a divorce. I mean, it's like 75 years. Like, internet, Kennedy, all that shit doesn't matter. I'm getting my pussy because I'm 99. It's time to go on. But it was just wild to me that after that much time, the fact that she had cheated on him in the 40s still mattered, you know? And I think that goes a long way to say what a lot of people were talking about tonight, which is sometimes it's easier said than done to forgive those trespasses that are trespassed against us. And my parents got divorced in 1991. I was 9 years old at the time. And from that point on, I was a kid who had a lot of toys. Call it vying for my affection, call it parental guilt, call it what you will. But one of my favorites was this He-Man action figure with a rotating battle chest plate. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Anybody have this toy? Yeah. Guys like, yeah, I know about that. So it was this He-Man action figure, right? And he had this chest of armor, yeah? Hit it once, right in the center, and it would spin to reveal the same piece of armor, but with a small diagonal dent. As if it had been hit by a tiny axe. Hit it again. And it would spin to reveal an even larger, uglier dent, this time from a blow that would knock even a so-called He-Man to the ground. Hit it one more time. And it would spin back to its original, pristine condition. All fiery, feather storm, fuck you fights forgotten, battle scars remembered but forgiven. Now, I had forgotten all about this toy. Until the night, when wrapped around each other in the sweet kiss of midnight, the sweat on our lips like mixed magic potion, right near the climax of our little sugar dance, you laughed. An out of nowhere, schoolyard bully kind of laugh, which you dismissed as nothing, but we both knew was something. And sweetheart, I know it was not your intention, but the sound of it sent staples into my sternum. Put a pin into my beating blue balloon and awoke the slumbering black jellyfish that lives between my lungs. Call him self-doubt, call him uncertainty, call him what you will. And that night, in the violet berry field of dreams, I saw a great wave rise over the Rockies. And so I jumped a dream jump into the garden of a lily pad princess, a girl I once knew who painted flowers with her tongue when she spoke. She made my blood blush, y'all. She was peppermint astronomy. Like her, freckled constellations were the closest thing I ever needed to home, my pretty little Milky Way. Call her the backbone of night. Call her the one that got away. Call her what you will. Her song was of charity. But when I asked her for a dance, she put her stove-hot hand into my stomach, pulled out the hummingbird that lives behind my ribcage cage, opened up her palm and said, you were a trespass on my bones. Your smile, your hands, they are the sticks and stones that break me every time we chance pass by. So tell me why. Tell me why your armor don't shine the way it used to. Why your heart wages a battle it will never find a truce to. In the midnight war field of dreams, I am crossing enemy lines, or maybe she's crossing mine. Either way, every time. Every time. Every time. Call it a gift of my bloodline. Call it passion's phantom. Call it history repeating itself. A sometimes swill of gasoline in my chest or He-Man's one regret. Call it what you will. Jagged revolutions yield. Jagged revolutions yield. Jagged revolutions. And my door has been revolving since the day she walked out of it and broke the key off in the lock. My parents got divorced in 1991. I was 9 years old at the time, and from that point on, I was a kid who had a lot of toys. Thank you.
Matt Zambrano. And that's it for our show. Thank you all so much for coming out. That was one of the best shows ever.